heading towards a statement that when s minus mz squared is sufficiently close to zero, which is to say that when this is of the order of alpha times mz squared, then we should be replacing this by something with an imaginary part of piece, which is, I'm going to argue, is this. And rather than, so one way to do this would be to follow through the arguments I gave you previously, that used unitarity to relate the imaginary part of a graph to the rate of the process you get by cutting the graph. And that's the hard way to do it. So an easier way to see how the numerical factors come in here is to go back to how, you know, this is a modification of the propagator. And what's doing the modifying is the fact that the particle has a lifetime. It's not a, you know, up until now we've been looking at, if this is the right answer, the result for an infinitely long-lived particle. So one way to think about how these factors appear is to go back to the derivation of the propagator in the first place and ask how would it have changed if the particle involved had been had a finite lifetime. So remember that when we talked about propagators came to us as being a time-ordered product of a field. We had vector fields, but let me write a scalar field just to make life easy in the vacuum. And the way we evaluated that was to take this thing, the time ordering, so it was something which asked, is x naught later than y naught? And then we had the x and y interchanged terms. And what we did was we inserted a complete set of states here. And the reason this thing cares about particle properties, was that once we put this complete set of states in, we had an integral. The thing that was contributing was the single particle states, because it was something which survived, for which the matrix element of the one field from the vacuum to the state survived. And so those are labeled by particles, momenta, and possibly spin. But if I'm doing spin zero particles, I can just forget the spin. We had time sum normalization. If I, you know, so here I'm writing it, what I've written here would be true if the states had been normalized to satisfy that PP prime is the delta function. P minus P prime. Because if that's the, once you know the normalization condition for a state, you also know what the completeness relationship is. And what I've used here is that 1 was the integral d3p of these states. But the states that I'm talking about that are used in the books, you know, have a different normalization here. So if you call it n squared, then you'd have over here 1 over n squared. But so all it's going to change, so what we want to ask is, how does this thing change given that the particle has a lifetime? Well, the particle having a lifetime, you know, what does that mean? It means that if I look at the late times and I compare it to early times, then the survival probability of that particle should be going like e to the minus gamma over 2, right? Because the probability of survival should be the square of that. T minus T prime. Because the probability of surviving, you know, over the interval tau should be the absolute value of T prime squared, where tau is T minus T prime. And so this amplitude, if we had not had, you know, what would that have been? If I compare particle states at successive times, they just differ by phase normally, which would have been e to the minus I, the energy times t, right? Minus t prime. So that would have been the normal time dependence. So what we're asking is one way of saying, if you have a particle which has a finite lifetime, of following what the lifetime does in an amplitude, is to imagine taking the energy and replacing it by shifting it by an imaginary part. So with the minus. What would I have to fish on? I want to shift this to get this, and so I would have to shift it by minus I over 2 gamma. So minus I times this would give me minus 1/2 gamma t, right? And I want to do this for all momenta. So if I, sorry, I lied. I want to do this in the rest frame. Because it's in the rest frame, when we calculate gamma, typically we're calculating the decay rate in the rest frame. So the energy in the rest frame is really the mass. So another way of saying this would be to take m goes to m minus I over 2 gamma in the calculation. And that actually captures the momentum dependence of the, if I ask for what the energy becomes, the energy, which is the square root of p squared plus m squared, if I shift it in this way, that goes to the square root of p squared plus m squared minus minus I times m gamma plus gamma squared. But if we're imagining that gamma is of the order of some coupling constant times m, so it's much, much less smaller than m. So I shouldn't really be allowed to keep this term, since we're neglecting corrections of order alpha, I should really always drop subleading corrections. And so if I, that also means that in the square root, I shouldn't keep gamma, I should expand in powers of gamma. And so if I did that, you know, this would become square root of p squared plus m squared minus I m gamma over the square root of p squared plus m squared. And you recognize that plus order gamma squared. But this is actually capturing correctly what the, if I use this here for states that had non-zero momentum, then the thing that would play the role of the decay rate would have been this whole thing in the general frame. And this extra factor here is exactly what you want, because this is what it, you know, the square root of, you know, for a relativistic system, p squared plus m squared is the energy, and that's the relativistic factor gamma times m, where gamma is, you know, the 1 over the square root of 1 minus v squared over c squared. And so what this is basically a factor of 1 over gamma, which is expressing time dilation of the decay. So the bottom line is that if we repeated the steps that we did to get from here to the propagator for the W particle and wanted to keep track of what it would mean for the particle involved in this complete set of states to have been have a finite lifetime, that's what we're asking to do in making this modification, because the instruction from a unitarity was that we're missing the fact, the important thing that's missed in the lowest order calculation of the cross section is that there's a correction to do with the lifetime of the particle, which is surviving, and it's dominating when you sit at the pole here. So if I want to know how does the lifetime appear in the propagator, I can repeat the steps I had before, and the short form of it is whatever I had before, I can just take m goes to minus I over 2 gamma, and that's going to capture the effects of a finite lifetime for this particle. And that makes it easy just to go and read off what happened to the propagator. It meant that when we have 1 over p squared plus m squared minus I epsilon, that should have gone to 1 over p squared plus m minus I over 2 gamma squared minus I epsilon. The I epsilon is now redundant because it was only there to tell us how to negotiate around the pole on the real axis here when we're integrating the momenta. And now the pole is not on the real axis because of this imaginary part. And I should also not keep the gamma squared term for the same reason. That's something which is higher order in alpha from what I'm keeping. I'm only trying to keep the leading correction to the pole, and so this is going to become p squared plus m squared minus I gamma m. And if I use that in the expressions that we've been using for the cross sections, I would have made this replacement like I told you we were going to. So that's kind of how to keep track of the fact. That's the easiest way to see how the factors of 2 and pi play out is to just follow what the lifetime would have meant in the expressions we were dealing with. So there's two reactions you could have to this. One would be, yeah, that's obvious. And the other is, that's such a hokey set of hand-waving that it's hard to believe that anyone believes it. So which are you? What does the silence mean? No, that's a good question. So you're saying, what had happened if we'd done a process where we had some particle here which happened to be stable? You're saying. This particular process we're looking at, you don't have to worry about that, because if we had this process, I in particular would also have this process. If it was kinematically allowed for me to sit on the mass shell here, then I could have imagined the process where I didn't actually produce the particle, I just started with the particle. And if I'm allowed to have this process, then that means it could decay, and here's the graph that describes its decay. So in this particular process, it's if you're having trouble because you're sitting on the at s equals m squared, then the process that you're looking at is describing a decay. And I'll show you in a second that if you look at the cross section, we can write it as being a factor in the limit that we're sitting right on this resonance. The cross section factorizes into the probability for producing the particle times the probability for decay. And that's kind of what you would have expected if you really had a physical particle going from A to B here. But in this case, because the problem only arises in a situation where you've explicitly you see that it had to decay, you can kind of see that there's never a situation where I'd have a particle on the S channel that I'd sit on and it couldn't decay. But in the T channel, it can happen. So if you had a process, you know, for photons, there was a case like this where the differential cross section went like 1 over T squared. And if you had a mass here, it can happen that you'd get a T squared, you know, minus M squared, where you can actually run over that pole. And then it can be a situation where it is a stable particle that you're exchanging, because nothing here forces you to. The kinematics is different in this direction than it is in that direction. And it's always true that if you have that situation, if you look carefully at what's going on, there's a class of graphs that's competing with the ones you're looking at, and you have to be careful which they are. And off the top of my head, I can't remember how this plays out. For photons, it's kind of a small angle story, because you're looking in that case, the t equals 0 is the one where your angles are almost 0. And if you think about scattering from charges, repeated multiple scattering from the charge is the thing that starts to dominate. So that things graphs like this for small angles start to compete with the one with one exchange. In the case when the mass is not 0, there's a similar story. And I can't remember exactly what the story is, but it's always true that if you could track it back, because you've emitted something which is as big as what you're keeping. And the divergence is showing you why you were wrong to neglect these other graphs. So the bottom line is, we had this expression for, you know, d sigma dt is minus pi alpha squared over s squared. I've done the integral over u, so I don't have a delta function. The number of colors times this left squared. And so if you now sit on right, so in this plot now, it no longer goes up to infinity, it turns over. But we can now sensibly talk about what happens at the minimum here, at the maximum. And we can also talk about how wide this thing is. And you can kind of see that those are going to be controlled by gamma, both the width and the height. The height will be controlled by gamma, because if you sit at, you know, if you evaluate 1 over s minus m squared minus I gamma m, you know, evaluate at s equals m squared, and you're getting 1 over I gamma m minus I gamma m. And so that's of the order of 1 over minus I alpha m squared. And so you're getting factors of 1 over alpha in the height here, which is what's making this peak high. And that's why in perturbation theory, it would have been very difficult to have seen this kind of behavior, because it's going in a singular way as a function of the coupling constant. So the height here relative to the generic height is of the order of 1 over alpha, typically. And the width here is controlled essentially by gamma, because the absolute value, if you kind of ask for if you plot this whole thing now, that thing squared, that's appearing, and the resonance, these A's are being dominated by this term, with there's a couple of constant factors in front. So on the resonance, this just becomes 1 over, you know, gamma squared m squared on resonance. But near resonance, it's, you know, this is the, this kind of a shape has the famous form, Runcin form. And the precise definition I want to say now is let me not say it carefully because I'll get this factor of the two right. Basically, if you ask kind of how you ask, if you go halfway down from the height here and ask how wide is it at half the height, then the answer there is it basically proportional to gamma. So the width of the peak at half the height, it's often called the full width half maximum, is a pure number times gamma. And so one way to measure gamma is to measure that width. So that you have two independent ways now to measure gamma. You can measure that width in this production cross-section, or you could produce a set of Zs and watch them decay. And you could count the number of times it goes to the various particles. And the advantage of doing it this way is that sometimes the Z was decaying into pairs of fermions, but sometimes those pairs of fermions are neutrinos that you don't see. And so at some point earlier on, people were asking, how do you measure the rate into neutrinos? And so now you can see one of the ways to do that is to compare what you see here to the things that you, if you summed over everything you actually can detect coming out, the muons and electrons, the difference has to be the rate into neutrinos. And you can compare that with the rate where you look for a process where the electrons go to fermions, but at some point a photon comes off that you see, so that the photon could have come off here. So if you look for a process where E plus E minus goes to a photon and nothing else, where these are now neutrinos, then you can relate, you can measure this. Measuring this is giving you a, you can infer, since you know how much the electric, how strong the coupling to the photon is, you can infer what the rate to neutrinos would have been. And you can compare that to what you learned when you looked at this width, and you compared it to the, when you subtracted from it, the sum of all the things that were visible. And the beautiful thing is that it all fits together just beautifully. But you really can measure the total width that way. All right. If you sit on the resonance, I want to just write something which expresses what I said a second ago. So on resonance. So Aij, remember, was a function of S. But if I evaluated it at mz squared, that just becomes 1 over sine squared theta cos squared theta, or 1 sine cos theta, of Gei Gfj over I times gamma z. And so all those cross-sections that I wrote before, that those A factors now are just numerical factors. And so if you can calculate things like implies that the cross section on resonance has a very simple expression. It becomes E to the fourth cosine theta cos squared theta times n colors of 48 pi times 1 over the width squared, coming from this factor squared. And the rest of it, remember that this m squared is going to go against, there's factors of m, that there are factors of s in the cross-section, which are now becoming factors of m because of where we're evaluating s, and so that the m's are canceling out here. On dimensional grounds, we already have the right dimension, so all that's left is dimensionless couplings. And you get ge left squared plus ge right squared. I could similarly have calculated the forward-backward asymmetry or the left-right asymmetry. And it's going to, again, be numerical factors times these g's. And there's no s's involved anymore because we're just evaluating at a particular spot. And you recognize that these various factors are related to the partial widths for Z to go into various, the branching fraction. Another way of writing this is 12 pi over mz squared. This number here times mz times these coupling constants was the branching fraction, or the rate for the z to decay into this particular pair of electrons, because in this graph, you know, that was what we evaluated to calculate the rate, and that was what we evaluated to calculate the rate of the fermion. So that what we've got here is the product of the rates to go into these specific kinds of particles. So this is the rate for z to go to e plus e minus divided by the total width, and the rate for z to go to FFR divided by the total width. And so you kind of see that what you've got is the let me write it this way. You can write this as being for e plus e minus go to z times the branching fraction for z to go to FF bar. Branching fraction, remember, was just the rate for this specific final state divided by everybody. And so this is the thing that I was saying to you a second ago, that once you're actually sitting on shell for a resonance like this, then what you're expecting to, what was generically happening in this kind of a case is that you were summing over all possible intermediate states and the energies and momentum were not related in any particular way. But when you sit on the resonance gets, the cross-section likes you to sit in the resonance. If you ask where is the most likely place for this to happen, it's here because the cross-section is large. And if you're sitting there, that means that the most likely possibility is that you're going to have the particle be on mass shell. The energy will be related to the momentum in just the way that would be required for the real particle. And in that case, what your kind of your intuition is that if you have real particles being produced, that that probability should then factorize, that you have some process for producing the Z particle in some collision. And then that Z particle gets created. And the longer it lives, the farther it goes. And so if this had been something which had been stable, or almost stable, but say it lived for you know, many, many, many years, and it was traveling close to the speed of light, you could produce this thing, you know, on the Andromeda galaxy and have it decay on Earth. And you'd expect these things to become independent events. And so then probabilities should start to factorize. And the amplitude just does that for you automatically, in the limit that the width is very small. Because everything I've used here, I've always expanded and kept only linear in gamma. And so provided that the state is very long-lived, then it more and more behaves as if it was a real, honest-to-God particle that was produced and then destroyed again. And then you could think of it as being an initial particle on its own right. And the total results kind of factorize into the production part and the decay part. And so all this, the story we had before of Z's decaying, you can imagine we're now filling in the rest of it. And that all would have applied to the full process sitting on the resonance. So the rest of this chapter is a bunch of odds and ends, right? It's the thing you need for the homework is mostly the crossing symmetry. What I should have brought, actually, and I will bring next time, is this sounds like just so many words, but if you now go to the you know, people measure this process in great detail, they did it at LEP, and there's a list of 25 odd observables that are very, very well measured at LEP. And many of them correspond to these various combinations at resonance, because that's such a well-measured process. They sat experimentally at this energy, and then they just accumulated all sorts of Zs, because that's where they like to be produced. And then because they had a lot of particles, they have good measurement. The statistical error in these things is quite low. And so in this list of things that people fit to in the standard model, you know, 3/4 of the list is special cases of this formula here. So it's an extremely useful formula. All right. So now what about T versus S channel processes? Let's say we're going to look at the lesson of the crossing symmetry is that you don't have to recalculate things over and over again every time you decide to think about a process. Once you've got a certain number of calculations under your belt, then you actually have got more calculations, you know, more amplitudes than you thought you did. So supposing that you're interested in a process, and we've just calculated a process like this, where some momentum came in, P1, P2, some momentum came out, K1, K2. Let me make sure I'm using the same variables as I was here. Well, no, I was using, let me, using P and K, P prime, K prime. Say this is what we've calculated. This is the S channel. It's the S channel because the thing appearing in this propagator here, the momentum that appeared here would be P plus K squared, and that's basically in this process S because it's the incoming momenta. Say we're interested in a process involving the same particles. This is fermion and fermion prime. So where the initial states, they're scattering from each other, but they're, so that this is F and F prime. So here we'd have P, K, P prime, K prime. The mechanics that you'd like to do here is to evaluate, you've got fermion, momentum P prime. You've got second fermion, momentum. Oh, unfortunate choice. Oh, no, that's not K prime. And the S matrix, an initial fermion P. Up here, what you had was the matrix element of fermion prime of K prime. And the idea is that the exercise you went through in calculating this and this are the same, essentially, because the interactions involved in the S matrix are the same. And only the details change in that when you go from, the amplitude that you write down here involves, there was a destruction operator here, which is now going to pick off an initial state, whereas before up here might be creating a final state. But the only difference that's appearing there is in the fields, the interaction always had a term. Say we focus on this thing here. We had fermion bar, gamma mu, G left, gamma left plus G right, gamma right, second fermion times Z mu, let's say. That was the thing in the Lagrangian. The thing that was actually doing the destroying or creating of these particles here was in the fields. And the fields came to you as a sum over spins and an integral over momenta times some factor, which I'm not going to write, times the spinner, P and sigma. You had an e to the I px and then a destruction operator. Then you had the antiparticle piece, V of P sigma e to the minus I px times the antiparticle iteration piece. And so the only real difference between this and this is, whereas here you might have been destroying a particle, so you're reading off this factor. Here you might have been creating an antiparticle, so you're reading off this factor. It's just basically a substitution between where you had a U before you have a V, you have a V afterwards, and it's just decided by is the particle involved in the initial state or final state. Here we had if I put the arrows in, I guess the way I've done it is the fermions and the antifermion like that. Here I've got like that. So here the fermion comes in with momentum P. And here it comes in momentum P. Nothing changed there at all. But here it was an antifermion coming in with an initial momentum K. And now it's a final fermion, not an antifermion, with momentum P prime. And so that this whole amplitude is going to be right. You could read it off from this amplitude by making the substitution, say U, V goes to U. And because the e to the IPX has gone to e to the minus IPX, some of the momenta are going to change sign as you go from initial states to final states. And so the crossing symmetry rules are just a mnemonic, which says that when you're calculating this amplitude, you make the following substitutions, and you have exactly the same result. And the reason it works is that the particles and antiparticles appear in a relative size, which is completely determined by Lorentz invariance. The spinners and the EDIPXs, there's no relative factor of 6 here. You were forced to have the relative normalization of the particle and the antiparticle come in a very specific way by Lorentz invariance. And so you're guaranteed that there's a universal way in which particles and antiparticles are participating in interactions. So the notes kind of work this through in detail for an example. But let me just summarize what the bottom line is. What it really comes down to, for the most part, is changing particle spinner for trading U's for V's, depending if you've got a particle becoming an antiparticle, and keeping track of the kinematics, that if the momentum, in this case, the momenta coming in at this vertex were both initial momenta, in this case, it's final momenta. And since we're expressing the cross-sections typically in terms of S, T, and U, we just have to keep track of, as you relabel the momenta for this process to this process, the definitions of S, T, and U will care about that, and so that you're going to involve permuting S, T, and U in particular ways. And you need to keep track of for that process in an expression like this one here. Everything I've been talking about here is to do with the amplitude. So, you know, all of this stuff came from the amplitude, from the S matrix element squared. This is the S matrix. Final state, S matrix, initial state squared. So these arguments I'm giving you here, these rules for substitution, are ones that apply to the amplitude. But these factors here are kinematic factors. So they came to you from, you know, these things came from things like d3p prime, d3k prime, over p0 prime, k0 prime. And those things are the same in this case. So I have p prime and k prime as being the final momenta. I don't care what particle carried those momenta. Those things are just momenta that I'm integrating over. And I'm always integrating over the final ones. So one of the factors of S came from that. The other factor of S came from the cross-section was given by, you know, there was a matrix element squared. There's a delta function. But there was also a flux factor. And that flux factor had a factor of S in it. That was always S because that was, the flux factor was defined to be, you were normalizing the rate for the process. You're factoring out the piece which is to do with the likelihood of the two particles to find each other. And that was to do with the number density of the particles times the relative velocity. And those things are always expressed in terms of the initial momentum because those are the things that are finding each other. It doesn't matter what type they were. It's just kinematics of how they find each other. And so these factors here, which are coming from kinematical things, you're not supposed to apply the substitution I'm about to describe to you too, because they are really entering the process in terms of initial and final momentum, which haven't changed. It's always initial momentum that are relevant for the flux factor. It's always the final momentum that were relevant for the phase space integrals. The only thing that these rules should be applied to are the matrix elements, because all it's really expressing in these rules is how the mechanics of evaluating this matrix element in terms of creation annihilation operators changes from going from here to here. And if you just follow through the algebra for the creation annihilation operators, because of the simplicity with which A and A bar appear in the fields, it's a very simple map that tells you how to relate the matrix element squared here to the matrix element squared here. And so since the square of that is the hardest part of the calculation, it's very useful to have the rule that relates them. So this is the thing for which the crossing symmetry rules apply. So let me make sure I do this right. So I'll wing it and see how it goes. So let's compare these two things. So for the S-channel process, we have the T-channel process. And again, it's T-channel because if I evaluate what the momentum is here, that momentum is, I could think of it as being, this is the guy coming in, so it's P minus P prime squared. And that was what I would have called T. I think it's probably minus T. That's minus T. So I'm just going to write the definition of the Mandelstam variables in both cases. S in the first case, let me call it, this is column 1, this is column 2. So S1 is, it's always the initial guys, right? So it's minus P plus K squared. T, in this case, is, I normally take it to be the fermion minus the, I should draw the arrows here again. So if P is the fermion, then I think I was defining T to be the fermion. This is the antifermion, this is the fermion. If it's fermion minus the antifermion squared, and the nu is always minus fermion minus the other final momentum squared. The pattern is that we chose one initial particle, the fermion in this case, and that's always one of these guys. And the other one is always the other initial particle and then the two final particles. And it's a conventional choice as to which one you use. You can switch T and U depending on whether you chose the fermion or the antifermion. So that's up to you a little bit how you define things. In the second process, the initial fermions here are P and P plus K squared. So if I take it here again, it's P minus P prime squared. I'm actually doing this, so probably a more useful way to do this, the way I've labeled these momenta is I've chosen to write these final guys as P prime and K prime, the initial guys as P and K, but a more useful thing to have done would have been actually to keep these labels, the fermion, P should go with the fermion, K should go with the antifermion, and so let me actually relabel these guys so that I'm following the momentum that goes with this particle the same. So this fermion is this fermion, so I'm going to use P here. This fermion is the one that's connected to it for the vertex, so I should really be using K here. This incoming, so this is a fermion, that's an outgoing fermion. This incoming fermion, you know, I would get this graph from this graph by taking this final state and making it an initial state, because then I'd have the fermion flow would be going out. So this would be the final fermion, so that means I should have written here P prime. Here I should have written K prime. And then having done that up to a sign, so in this particular case, for instance, K was flowing out. Here K is flowing in, so there's a sign going on. If I had actually tried to go from here to here, I'd have to keep track of that sign. But that'll come up over here. The utility of doing it this way is that I'm now, the thing that's appearing in the fields is exactly the same variable all the time. And so the rule for expressing the amplitudes is going to be simple. I write it the same momenta associated with the same particle type here. But the purpose of this table now is to take these to see how the kinematic variables change. The initial state guys here are P and K prime. The final state guys, I have the fermion, and the final fermion will be P minus K. And then U is now P minus the other one would be P prime. And if I use conservation of form momentum, I can always rewrite these things as being P plus K is the same as P prime plus K prime. P minus P prime is the same as, you know, what I'm using here is that, in this case, P plus K is equal to P prime plus K prime, because that's the expression of form momentum conservation here. So P minus P prime is the same as K minus K prime. And this is, P minus K prime is the same as P prime minus K. And I write that because you can see that it's so I take P and K prime. And I gotta follow the signs now. So here I had K going in, here I have K going out. So I should have actually made the replacement K goes to minus K. So that's, this is the definitions. If I want to now take this, these are, so what I've got here is a definition. I'm going to make a replacement. I guess I'm going to start with this one. I'm imagining that we've calculated this. I want to get this. So I'm going to take, this is the definition. To kinematically convert from here to here, P was going in both cases. So I'll take P to P. Here, k was an incoming momentum, and I want it in this graph to be an outgoing momentum, so I'm going to have to take k goes to minus k. Here, p prime is outgoing, p prime is outgoing. And here, k prime is outgoing, k prime is incoming, so I have to get k prime goes to minus k prime. And so if I take these definitions and make these replacements, they're going to look like these definitions. And so let me rewrite these definitions a little bit farther over here so we can. So I have S2 minus P is k prime squared. That was T2. So with this substitution, then so which one is going to look like this? So I take here I've got a p and a k. So if I take this one and I make this substitution here, then s1 goes to, with this substitution, minus p minus k squared, and you recognize that that's just that's t2. Here. I want something which looks like something over there. That's this one. So T1, with the substitution P equals to P, P prime equals P prime, nothing happens. Goes to minus P minus P prime squared. And that's U2. And U1 has to be, we want the P plus K prime version. That's this one. So we have, so P goes to P, but K goes to, K prime goes to minus K prime. That goes to minus plus k prime squared, and that's S2. So it shows you that there were spinners U and V in here that we'd have to keep track of. The particle going to an antiparticle means that in the amplitude we had U go to V. But in the end of the day, in this, when we do a spin sum, we had UU bar and VV bar, and those are essentially the same up the signs. And so in the relativistic limit, there actually. The bottom line is that if you're keeping track of the masses, you have to be more careful with these U's and V's. But in the relativistic limit, it's actually very simple because U bar and V bar are the same. Up to sine, and the sine tends to drop out of the cross section because you're squaring things. So if we want this crossed process, now we're really interested in the process. In this case, A involved the sum, you know, over the photon in the Z graph. And so if we really wanted the sum here, Z plus photon, as we did here, it's the same argument. That's why it's such a powerful argument. Is that we can just lift this cross section, and what we're supposed to do. So this is now. This was for E plus E minus, or say fermion bar was a different kind of a fermion bar. This is now fermion prime goes to fermion prime. So the kinematic factors up front won't change. The number of colors came from summing over the final state here. We don't do that anymore because in this cross channel, the colors in the final state are fixed by the colors in the initial state, so there's not a special sum over that. And this kinematic factor here, these are all functions of S. Now they've become, so we were supposed to take S and make this replacement, it became T. U became S. And T became U. And so we're done. So if you specialize this, you have to be careful. The cases that are best understood are the ones where everybody's an electron. And when everybody's an electron, you remember there's a caveat because these graphs were not the whole story if we had electron-positron goes electron-positron because they were also cross graphs. So you've got to be careful about that particular point. But if we apply that to the fermions for which that's the whole story, then you can read off what the cross-sections are, and I don't know how instructive it is to write them down here. You can also see that if we had been interested in a process where we had a W boson here rather than a Z, there's electron neutrino scattering, for instance, can happen when you have Z exchange, if it's the same, neutrino or W mass, W boson exchange. And it's like also easy to lift off these expressions because all you're really changing is the masses involved and the couplings involved. And so that all these Gs that were in these things depend on the left and right handed couplings. And so you have a different expression for what they are for the W boson. In particular, all the right handed couplings are zero. So you just lose all these three terms and you just have the one factor. So there's an awful lot of information buried in these cross sections. All right. I'm not going to go through the, unless there's a real, so the book now talks about Muller scattering and Compton scattering. And I think it's actually more instructive to work through those exercises than just have me tell you about them. So unless there's a complaint, that's what I'm going to do. Where do you guys want to go with this now? We're getting to a point where we have some options. And there's not an infinite amount of time left. And I'm getting a sense that you're all bored out of your minds right now. Is that fair? You've become passive in a way that you weren't before. Well, so as far as I'm concerned, the rest of the book is good. So, you know, the next topic that's in here is, I think it's infrared divergences. That there's, you know, if you sum photons from external lines, give you large logarithms at some level, and that's useful in practice, but it's one of those things that's it's fairly specialized, and it may not be up your alley. The next thing after that is effective field theories a little bit. That's something which we probably should do. And then after effective field theories, then there's a big bifurcation because the chapters 8 and 9 in the book would have been strong interactions. That would have been chapter 8 is hadrons and what's the qualitative features of the properties of the hadrons given the quarks. So, you know, what do you know about the quantum numbers and the folklore about how big the masses should be? And then chapter 9 is about their interactions. What can you say about the interactions given the perturbation theory is not working for the strong interactions? And so there's several things you can say depending on what, in some limits there's things you can say. So at high energies, perturbation theory works really well. At low energies, there's symmetries in the problem that that also work well in certain circumstances. And so so there's a whole rich story there that a lot of what you know about the standard model is to do with actually the hadrons. And so we could do that for the rest of the class if you wanted to. I've never taught this before and got through those two chapters before the term ended. So there's enough material there that if we did it all, we could do everything. We could spend all our time doing that. We can also cherry pick. There's a particularly interesting thing is neutral meson mixing. You know, KK bar mixing and BB bar mixing. You learn a particularly lot in that system, and that's probably one thing that is worth seeing. But you may or may not be interested in knowing about partons and how, you know, to calculate high energy scattering with hadrons. And then chapter 10 is neutrinos. So that's kind of the first of beyond the standard model. And then chapter 11 is kind of beyond the standard model. So it just goes through a variety of things that are, you know, so a little bit of supersymmetry, a little bit of grand unified theories, a little bit of, there's something else in here, what an axion is, things like that. We could spend everything, all the rest of the time we could spend on that. These are the things that kind of, they go on forever. But, so that makes it sound like you'd like to have at least a significant chunk on that, but that's more interesting to you. Someone else actually earlier also said that, maybe it was you, so somebody was saying that they were interested in the beyond the center model for it. You know, there's also loops, if you want to know loops. We can do an example of renormalization. Okay. Because that's actually in the effective field theory chapter 7. There's an explicit calculation. There's the one loop done in this whole thing is done in the running of the couplings is done in the middle of chapter 7. That's at the end of chapter 9. What's that? Now the thing about KK bar mixing, it's just like neutrino. It's actually a natural thing to do before you do neutrinos because the same way that neutrinos oscillate, things will oscillate if you have a particle and it's an antiparticle, they're different, but there's no conserved quantum number that distinguishes them. Then they can oscillate. And that happens for neutrinos, but it also happens for the bound state of a D and an S bar, because in that case the electric charge is zero. If flavor had been conserved, so the weak interactions weren't there, then you could distinguish them because they have different strangeness or something. But it's not conserved, and so they really are not distinguished by a conserved quantum number, so they can oscillate. And because they oscillate, it turns out that the mass, you can measure the mass difference extremely well because you're looking at the beating of two frequencies which are very close, and it turns out that the mass difference, you can measure it. I forgot the number now. It's like 10 to the minus 12 MeV or something like that. So it's some number you'd never imagine that you can measure a number that well. And the fact that you can gives an extremely strong constraint on the standard model, because lots of things screw up the standard model prediction for that. Because if you kind of take a generic theory and you ask how big would that mass difference be, it's typically, if the leading order perturbation theory, you can answer which is bigger than what's seen observationally. And the standard model happens as a cancellation of the leading order, and you get a sub-leading thing, which is the thing that you actually see. And so that means it's a very sensitive test to deviations from the standard model. So if we how many lectures do we have left? We have, I'm here all the rest of the term, so, and it depends on when we stop in April, but we have the four lectures in March and February 28th. So that's, okay. What do the rest of you think? Does anyone? Think you? Can't be one. Well, for that, it divides into two parts. One of it is what can you say about the bound states? Because the idea is that the quarks are bound into the hadrons, And how do you know the properties of the quarks given what you know about the properties of the hadrons? And so there's general things that you can say, like if you have the charge conjugation and parity properties, because an argument like this, that the Lorentz invariance is telling you in a very specific way how the particle and the antiparticle are related. And in particular, it tells you that you typically have an arbitrary phase you can choose in the parity you can assign parity to a particle. But there's always a choice of the intrinsic parity that you get to choose, and you get to choose it in a way that makes parity be conserved, if you can. But you don't get to choose the parity of the particle and the antiparticle independently of one another. And so if you had a bound state of two particles that were different from each other, the overall parity of the whole thing is not just governed by the Anger-Mentum quantum numbers of the bound state. It also depends on the intrinsic parity of the particles that are involved. But if you make something out of a particle and antiparticle, like you do for the mesons, then the intrinsic parity of the particles, the quarks themselves, cancels, because it's always minus one squared. And so that means that you have an absolute prediction for the parity and the charge conjugation quantum numbers of the bound state in terms of its angular momentum, say. So that could, you know, that could have failed. And it also depends on the spin of the thing that's there. So the fact that all the mesons you see exactly match what you should see for spin a half fermion, antifermion is a non-trivial piece of evidence that that's really what they are. And they also transform under these approximate flavor symmetries where U, D, and S get rotated into one another. Those are not exact symmetries, but they're approximate. So that means that the states that have that are related by the symmetry should be close to the same mass. And so there's formulas for the, if the mass of the quarks had been zero, then those would have been exact symmetries, because the thing that's breaking the symmetry in the strong interactions is really only the quark masses. And so the, if the masses had been zero, then they would, these particles would have the same mass. But because the masses are small, you can perturb in the masses, and you can kind of make a prediction for how the spacing between the masses depends on the quark masses. And it turns out that there's more masses than there are quark masses, so you get a prediction for what, an absolute prediction for what the pattern should be, which also works. And so there's things like that that are kind of more detailed than normal statements as to why you believe that these things really are built out of quarks and hadrons, and why you really believe that the QCD has actually got something to do with how they were held together. But it's, at some level, it's also fairly specific to the strong interactions. That's the bound state parts. And then the interaction part is what do they do? And so So there's various limits you can look at. So the chiral perturbation theory would be the limit, where at low energies, the same symmetries that describe how the things are, how the, which states are degenerate with each other, also restricts how. It turns out that there's some of the symmetries. There are some symmetries which describe, which relate the particles that are there, and there's other symmetries that are spontaneously broken. And so those ones have Goldstone bosons, and that's what these mesons are. And their interactions are controlled by the Goldstone bosons. Always have interactions that are governed by the symmetries involved, and not much else. So you can say a lot about how pions, for instance, interact, just knowing that they're the Goldstone bosons. And so there's a whole story about what the pion interactions look like at low energies. And there's a story of partons, which is if you collide things from protons, you know, at very large momentum transfer, then it's like for an atom. If you really slowly move an electric field past an atom, the whole atom recoils. But if you really whang something hard off of an atom, it'll hit the electron. The electron will scatter like it didn't know the atom was there, because it's happening so fast that the time scale of the atom to respond is too slow. And so then you can actually see the fact that the electrons are in atoms, because you can hit them individually, and you can see that you're scattering from a point particle rather than from the whole atom. And for hadrons, it's the same thing. If you collide things from protons at high energies, at high momentum transfers, you actually recoil from the quark individually. And that was part of the evidence for that. They were, you know, explicitly, they look like they're made of quarks, because you look at this, you get a Coulomb scattering cross-section from them in a point-like one. So the whole story of how that goes through is another part of the interaction thing. We could, that's actually one of the sections here, and that's actually particularly useful for LHC. But it tends to get bogged down into, that's one thing we could do, we could just do that. But it tends to be, there's a lot of machinery there, because there's a lot of things to do with, what it comes down to is that in principle, what should have happened is that you would think you'd have a coherent scattering from everything in the proton, and you'd add up the amplitudes and then square them. But in practice, if you hit them hard enough, it's incoherent, because and so it's the probabilities that add, not the amplitudes. And so so what happens is that for the resonance, you had the probability for the whole process would factorize into the probabilities for subprocesses. There's a story for the protons that you hit an electron or another proton from it, and you can write the answer as being the sum of the probabilities where it's the cross section at the quark level times the probability of finding a quark to scatter from with a given energy range, you know, and you sum over all possible energy range and the probabilities of finding the quarks in a proton. That kind of. So the build the machinery takes a while, but we could do it if there's interest. It's a question of where you're going. You know, if you're interested in phenomenology, that's probably very useful, because that's going to be, people will talk about that a lot in the next couple of years, because the LHC is going to do that. And so it's really going to be proton-proton scattering, actually. And so that it's the language, you know, will be coming up a lot. But not everyone's interested in that detail of phenomenology. So what we could do is take a poll. Thing is, I could ask you to go off and talk about it amongst yourselves, but the thing is, you're then going to go to different universities and you won't talk to each other. So by a show of hands, I mean, if you kind of went through so there was one of the topics was loops and an example of renormalization. So that would be explicitly calculating a loop, dimensionally regularizing it, and then renormalizing it. So who would be interested in seeing that? This would be for QED, probably, just for gauge theory. Yeah, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Yeah. So this is loops. Another one was the parton story. So that I guess first there was not the dynamics, but the QCD and bound states. Who wants to see that? 1, 2, 3, 4. Is your hand down? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Then there was partons and scattering. So that's the thing about recoiling things off of the proton and what you see in the LHC. Yeah? Because the thing is that I'd have to tell you, who's in the proton, but so like it's UUD. Now you know. And this is kind of more detailed. This is saying more than just that. But if you go through all the possible combinations of quark, anti-quark, and well, first of all, what are the loud things? It's always quark, 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 and quark, anti-quark. Why is that true? And it's because it's color neutral. And then the thing is that you should be getting, if you take all possible combinations of quarks of that type, you should get exactly no more and no less than the mesons that you see and the baryons that you see, and you do. That's kind of one of the amazing things, that you get no more and no less than what you should see. And so this is kind of a lot about the spectroscopy, and some bound states are kind of not exactly quark eigenstates, or there's sums of quark eigenstates, and why that's true, and things like that. Whereas this, all you really need to know is that there's gluons and quarks, say up and down, and for the proton, and you're really more interested in what's the probability of finding them with specific momentum, given that they're there. But you don't care much about the wave function or anything. So in principle, you could do this and not do that if you wanted to. It contains SU3, yeah. It would be, yeah, it would contain, it would certain amount of that. It would be the kind of thing that you learn in the 60s. It's perturbation theory. The quantum numbers of the bound states, which involves saying what the symmetries are. So it's SU, SU3 cross SU3, and one of them is broken, one's not broken, and the one that's not broken is the one that normally you think about as SU3. And then what does that mean for the spectrum? And what would be the selection rules you'd expect? So who would like to see this? This is the partons and the LHC kind of thing. 1, 2. Your hand's not up, right? You're not sure. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Then there was things like KK bar mixing, BB bar mixing. Would like to see that. That was the oscillations and the precision tests of the standard model. A lot of them are based on that. So this is one, it looks like. This is it's a good preamble for neutrinos if you want to see neutrinos later on, because they were thinking about this in the 60s and before the neutrinos came along. And it's also true that if you're interested in what you could replace the standard model with, one of the first things you have to worry about is what are the kind of constraints you have to worry about. And so which of the observables are the ones, if you modify the standard model in this particular way by adding Higgses or more W bosons or something, what are the things that you change that are dangerous? And this is one of the classic ones that's dangerous. If there's any flavor changing, because this mixing allows you to measure the difference between two meson masses incredibly accurately. And it also is the first place you see CP violation happen. And it happens, it turns out, at second order in the standard model, because the first order piece happens to be small because something cancels. That means that if you kind of change the standard model and you ruin that cancellation, then you actually get a bigger contribution than the standard model would have given you, even though you've changed the standard model by a small piece. And so one of the first things you have to always check when you're changing the standard model is this particular system, because it's such an incredibly precise test. So that's the main motivation for it, is that it's extremely, it's like 10 to the minus 12 MeV measurements. So who'd like to, so if that was one on the menu, who'd want to see that? 3, 4. And then there's neutrinos. That's neutrino oscillations. Who'd like to see that? 1, 2, 3. Yeah, what the hell, yeah. 3. Because this is like the first beyond the standard model. We don't have time to do it all is the thing. So that's kind of why prioritizing is worth it. And then beyond the standard model, it would suggest, it would breaks up into the hierarchy problem and Susie. And then there's a strong CP problem and axions. And there's grand unified theories. There's also, I think, there's a section there on triviality problem, which is, does it make sense to have a Higgs arbitrarily heavy? So of these, you know, who'd like to, I guess the first thing before subdividing it, who would want to see this somewhere? Everybody, I figured. Okay, so who would like the Susi hierarchy problem one specifically? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And the strong CP problem in axions? 1, 2, 3, 4. Well, put your hand up every time then. Was your hand up here? I don't know if I can. Yeah? It was. Okay, 4, 1. Okay, and then the grand unified theories? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. All right. And then triviality in this. You guys are so retro. Grand unified theories is, I can remember grand unified theories. All right, so if you rank that, I'd say that, so that means that it looks like we want to do this. And so the first priorities would be those. And the next one would be that. And then after that, I kind of, there's a whole bunch of things that are similar. Well, we probably have time to do all three of those if we're going to do three. I'm surprised you don't want to see neutrinos. Because that's the first beyond the standard model we actually know happened. So I'm going to force you to do neutrinos, I think. But maybe not all of neutrinos, just like the bare bones of neutrinos. Because it's, if you're going to do these ones, particularly this one, the way to think about this one is that you had all the normalizable things, and then now you start adding non-normalizable things. And this is the second non-normalizable thing you could have added. So the first thing you should ask is, what was the first one? And it turns out that's this one. So you might as well, if you're going to do these ones, you might as well do them together. SU5, SO10, but not in great detail. Yeah, so the baryon number violation, that kind of thing, yeah. Okay, so let's do that. So and we'll see how time goes. So this, I'll soft pedal this. If I do this, I'll probably just do a minimum of this, just because it's the same problem. It's the statement that if you naively the mass of the Higgs was the coupling of the Higgs to itself. You know, we had lambda phi to the fourth potential times v squared or something like that. There was a formula like that. And if you take lambda larger and larger and larger, you're getting a larger Higgs mass. But at some point, you don't believe this formula anymore because it was all done in perturbation theory. So if you ask, let me make sure I say this right. If you ask on a computer what happens if you make the coupling large, the mass actually gets larger than it. Basically, it doesn't get any larger anymore. It just sits at the same place, and just the Higgs gets wider. because it interacts more and it has a faster decay rates. Because typically, the rate was typically a coupling times, you know, the mass, something like that. So you make a coupling larger, it tends to get wider, it's shorter lived. But you might say, well, so, but all these couplings are renormalized, as you'll see. And so if you, so you often will read that people will say that this is more like an attack on things, because the people will often say that couplings run, and if they run at QCD has the property that the higher the energy is, the lower the coupling gets. But in scalar field theories, and in particular this field theory. For scalar fields, the coupling gets larger as you go to larger energies. And so at some point, you know, as you get to higher and higher energies, the coupling just takes off. And so then in the old days, when people thought about renormalization and that the cutoff is actually supposed to go to infinity, then that would mean that something has to happen. The coupling can't go to infinity at some finite value and still take the cutoff to infinity. So what you have to do to get the cutoff higher and higher is you have to lower the renormalized coupling. And so the statement was that if you had a Higgs scalar field theory or electrodynamics is also has a property that gets larger at higher energies, that the only theory that makes sense in the limit of infinite cutoff is a free theory. And that's why so it's called triviality, because that means it's a trivial theory when you in the quantum level. And so the attack is, you know, yeah, but the cutoff isn't infinite. It's some finite thing. And so there's a quantitative issue. The physics issue is, what can you learn about how high the cutoff can be given what you know about the coupling of the Higgs or the coupling of the electromagnetic? You know, is there any interesting constraint there? And the bigger the coupling is, the lower the cutoff has to be. But it turns out that it's logarithmically sensitive, so it's not something which is most useful piece of information in the problem. But it gets talked about much more than it should, because people that are my age and older tend to think in terms of the cutoff being infinitely large, and so they think it's a really powerful constraint. So mostly this is the reason why you shouldn't take those papers very seriously. So I wouldn't sell that as a topic you'd necessarily want to do if you're selecting topics. So let me write that down so I don't forget them. Does someone have a pen I can borrow? And does anybody think that there's something you need for the assignment that's not on that list? I don't know if you've all got to the end of it. Because the crossing symmetry was something you saw on the assignment. And someone earlier today was saying that there, I think you were worried that there was not enough. We hadn't covered everything yet. Yeah, the thing about complex scattering is that it's just a big ugly mess. it's just a long calculation, and unfortunately I could do it if you all want to do it, but it's something which is not so instructive apart from me writing down what the formulas are. But it's really something which you learn by doing it, but it's by seeing me do it, you're not going to learn much. It's in the book mostly because it's the first example where you're going to final state a photon, and so some of the things that come into the calculation, you couldn't have just lifted these calculations and gotten the Compton scattering. And there are a couple things that come up in the Compton scattering that are kind of first come up in that case, and so it's worth having it in the book as an example, and it's worth you thinking it through. But I don't get a sense that you guys are really enthralled by the discussion of the cross sections.
So that's one of the reasons why I was going to skip it.
I guess the topic I didn't put down there was effective field theories. If I had put effective field theories down, that's chapter 7 for the most part, it would have been one of the. So that was not enough to really change it. Okay, two. Okay. I mean, we hit it along the way anyway in these things.
Okay. So let me just, before going, write down one thing. So the goal will be, I'll work through the example that's in the book here so you have something to compare to.
So I'd start with loops, I guess. That's the. You know, rather than having me start now, if I wing it now, I'm going to screw something up. Let me prepare a little bit because there's some preamble that I should say before diving into the calculation, which I'll do next time. So I'll start with loops next time. My plan will be loops, and then go from there to beyond the standard model because that's what the main other ones are. But I'm going to insert this as being one of the other things just because. This naturally goes with this, and then this naturally goes with this, but I won't do the whole topic. I'll just kind of skim a piece of this, a piece of this, and go to these. Okay, so let's stop.